no regrets about having made that decision. It was time. I didn't want people to say, be going around saying, when the heck is he gonna leave, you know? Isn't it time? I'd rather have them say, gee, did he have to leave when he's leaving? We would have liked him to stay longer. And I'm getting some of that.
Disney's Bob Iger speaking to CNBC last year during what was, at the time, an exit interview. Bob Iger served as Disney CEO for 15 years, then stayed on as executive chairman until the end of 2021 to help the company's new CEO, Bob Chapek. Well, in an eye-popping shakeup announcement yesterday, Iger is returning as Disney CEO to replace his hand-picked successor. Disney's board ousted Chapek, effective immediately, even though it voted to renew his contract just in June. For more on this, we've invited Matt Bellany on. He's the founding partner of Puck News, where he covers money and power in Hollywood. Welcome back, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
Well, you wrote a column last week about Bob Iger's persistent trash talking of Bob Chapek, but did you or anyone else not named Bob have an inkling this was coming?
I did not. I mean, I wrote that because it kept coming back to me that Iger was out there saying negative things about a guy that he handpicked to succeed him, which is somewhat unusual in the CEO world. And Iger is just this kind of figure around town. So and he was doing meetings with investors, which is something that you typically do when you are running a company, not when you previously ran a company. So I didn't know this was going to happen, but the tea leaves were all there. And it now makes perfect sense what was going on.
Well, even Iger himself made it seem that he was surprised in his announcement last night. He wrote, with an incredible sense of gratitude and humility, and I must admit a bit of amazement that I write to you this evening with the news that I'm returning. How amazed was he, really?
I mean, that is the Iger wit and grace, I think. He very much wanted this outcome, I think, for a few months now. I have been told that the actual call did not come until very recently. Disney had a pretty disastrous earnings call a couple weeks ago where they revealed that they lost $1.5 billion in a quarter on streaming alone. And that, I have been told, was the final straw with the board. But there have been rumblings for a while back this summer, right after Chapek was renewed, and even before that, that it just wasn't a good fit. He had stumble after stumble. He got into a fight with the Florida governor. He got into a fight with Scarlett Johansson. He was not as respectful to the creative community, had no creative experience. And this was sort of, it was one of those things that had kind of been gurgling, and then all at once.
Yeah. Even though during that revenue call, they did say that revenue was up by like 9% year over year. So they did make money, just not on streaming.
And they missed their projections, which Disney very rarely does. Very rarely misses what they say they're going to perform at. And that was very embarrassing. And also there was a tone issue. I mean, Chapek was on that earnings call, which I listened to, and he was going on and on about how great things are. And he's talking about the, you know, the theme nights at Disneyland and the Oogie Boogie Bash and all these things. And all of the analysts were looking at it being like, oh my gosh, that's a $1.5 billion loss in streaming. Why isn't he talking about that?
Well, I guess he didn't want to talk about that because that was such a huge loss. But looking at
Iger, Iger would address bad things and sort of smooth them over in a way that made people feel comfortable. And then lo and behold, 2 days after this earnings call, Chapek announces that they're going to have layoffs and everybody freaks out. And it just seemed like a knee-jerk reaction because the stock dropped again. And he kind of lost the confidence of both the board and the people that he was working with. And when that happens, you got to make a change.
Right. Well, let's talk a little bit about streaming because it's not just Disney Plus that's doing badly. Netflix is having problems. So is this more a problem affecting the broader industry, or are there specific problems to Disney?
Well, Chapek has problems personally, but the overall trends in the industry are not good for anyone. I mean, this run-up in streaming subscribers, which has been the focus of Hollywood for the past 5 to 7 years, spend to get as many subscribers as you can worldwide. Wall Street has absolutely turned on that, and they don't believe that these streaming services are ultimately going to be as profitable or as impactful as they once did. That is, I call that the great Netflix correction. All of these companies have pivoted to become largely streaming companies because they wanted those tech-oriented valuations by Wall Street. Now it's a new game. These analysts are looking at profitability, not just subscribers. And Disney's streaming service has one of the lowest revenue per users of any of them. They've got to fix that.
Right. And the irony is that that was one of Iger's biggest achievements, was creating Disney Plus, leaving the company after 15 years in a healthy position, and also with this bright new future that would be streaming.
And what Iger did is he purposely priced Disney Plus low. It was initially $7. So they would get a ton of subscribers right away. And if you remember, they got 10 million subscribers on the first day that Disney Plus existed. It's taken streamers like Peacock a long time to get there. Peacock's still at only 15 million. But the downside of pricing it so low and doing all of these partnerships to get it into onto everybody's phone, the downside is that the revenue they were generating from this service was relatively low. And Iger did that on purpose, but now it's a different world. They've got to pivot. And they're already doing that. They're raising the price of Disney Plus to $11 in the U.S. on December 8th. But they've got to really figure out how to make more money off of streaming.
Okay, so what will Iger do? He's got 2 years, apparently. He's, I guess, going to groom another successor. Hopefully, he'll pick someone better or more qualified, or someone that people would like more. But what has he got to do in these next 2 years?
Well, the board said in their press release that succession is a big part of his job. He's got to find someone. This is a guy who retired and unretired three times and had successors in the past, and he kind of, you know, marginalized all of them. So this time the board is saying it's for real. He's got to find someone to replace him. And he's also got to set a strategic course, is how they characterized it, meaning figure out what the long-term vision is for Disney in the digital age. Is it going to be one unified streaming service around Disney Plus, or are they going to continue to have Hulu and ESPN Plus and Hotstar overseas? Are they going to spend what they're spending to compete in streaming? Are they going to still have ESPN? Are they going to sell that off because it doesn't make as much money as it used to? These are all very big strategic decisions that Iger's going to have to make over the next couple of years. I don't actually think he can do it in two. I think he'll probably extend a little bit and, you know, stay on for 3, maybe 4 years. But that's the mandate right now, and succession is a big part of it.
All right. Matt Bellamy covers Hollywood for Puck News. You can hear him every Friday here on KCRW at 2:30 and 6 on The Business with Kim Masters. Matt, thanks.
Thank you.
Pop superstar Taylor Swift swept the American Music Awards last night, winning in 6 categories, including Artist of the Year.
I have the fans to thank, essentially, for my happiness. And I love you more than I can say.
Many of her fans, though, are still unhappy after major glitches crashed the online sale for tickets to her upcoming tour. The company in charge of ticket sales, Ticketmaster, is now the target of many lawmakers and attorneys general, quite possibly the DOJ itself, and legions of devastated Swifties. Here to talk about how we got here is Dean Budnick. He is editor-in-chief of the music magazine Relics and co-author of the book Ticketmasters, The Rise of the Concert Industry and How the Public Got Scalped. Welcome to Press Play, Dean.
Thank you.
Okay, so this ticket debacle started with a pre-sale last Tuesday, and her biggest fans would get special early access to tickets before anyone else, but it turned out that that was the only day any tickets would be sold. And so that crashed the site, and lots of people were unhappy. What happened, and how did this happen?
Well, what happened is a few things. First off, beyond the people who were given the actual codes, there were some individuals who were held in reserve in case those people, in case all those tickets didn't sell through initially, many of whom rushed in. But above and beyond that, there were any number of folks who didn't have codes who wanted to try to buy tickets. There were some Taylor Swift fans who simply figured, what the heck, I might as well give it a go. And there were plenty of people who wanted to try to buy tickets so that they could then resell them to Taylor Swift fans. And among these, there were some individuals who deployed bots, you know, computer algorithms that are meant to sort of brute force the system so they could bypass some of the safety mechanisms and get in and grab some tickets.
Okay, so is this the first time that this has happened, or is this an ongoing problem with Ticketmaster?
Well, listen, on this scale, right, because here you had 47 stadium shows essentially being sold simultaneously. Some of the West Coast dates were pushed a little bit later in the date. But, I mean, bots are sort of an ongoing issue for Ticketmaster. It's happened off and on over the years. There was a Bruce Springsteen on sale, not the most recent one, but a one a number of years back, where there were all these bots crashing the system. Ticketmaster does actively do what it can to revise its system, to police it and the like in an attempt to push back the bots, but it's sort of a cat and mouse game, as it's been described to me.
Okay, well, let's talk about Ticketmaster and how big it got, because it's owned by Live Nation, which is also the biggest live events company in the United States. And so how does that partnership, if you will, work?
Sure. Well, I mean, in theory, there is something of a firewall between the two, because I think when Live Nation and Ticketmaster came together in 2010, some people feared that when, you know, Ticketmaster sales team went out and tried to get new clients, and to be clear, their clients are essentially the venues out there, that they would intimidate individuals by saying, listen, if you're not going to use Ticketmaster, then you're not going to have Live Nation artists come through your facility. So, I mean, that's, you know, that part and parcel is some of what, you know, is going on behind the scenes, some concerns relative to that. But above and beyond that, Ticketmaster has become so huge by simply reconfiguring the game. They altered the nature of the business model for ticketing. This happened in the early 1980s. Previously, tickets were something of an expense for an arena, for a facility that you would use in an attempt to sort of market your shows, get them out there to fans, to would-be concert goers through remote access and the like. And Ticketmaster, at that moment, decided they were going to change things a little bit. Service fees were low, but Ticketmaster, under the leadership of Fred Rosen, the CEO, went out to all these arenas and said, hey, what would you think if we doubled the service fees? And the arenas said, at first, why would we want to do that, with the thought that it would detract people from buying tickets? And Rosen's team said, well, if we do that, we will share the revenue with you. And so instantly, this became a revenue source rather than an expense, and Ticketmaster went around the country winning new contracts with venues, and these contracts were exclusive. Ticketmaster would say, you have to have an exclusive arrangement with us, you have to let us sell 100% of your ticket inventory, and in exchange, we'll give you an advance against the service fees, and we'll give you a signing bonus. And so as Ticketmaster went out, starting again in 1982, increasingly it became very easy to sign on new venues who were more than willing to have this new revenue source come in.
Yeah. And then so now there's only this one outlet pretty much selling tickets to concerts across the country, right? And then you have this one site. And then if there's an overwhelming demand, as we saw last week with Taylor Swift concerts, it can be overwhelmed. So how is this being policed or not policed by federal and state authorities if actually the Justice Department approved this merger in the first place?
Well, that is a great question. All that the Justice Department did when it approved this merger in 2010 and then reaffirmed it in 2019 is it said, don't intimidate venues when you're trying to get new clients. But what it didn't say, what it didn't necessarily think, was that Ticketmaster was any form of a monopoly. And if you were to listen to Ticketmaster, they would say, listen, we're not a monopoly. We only do 25% of the ticketing nationwide. And that's probably essentially true, but that 25% includes, you know, junior high school basketball games and, you know, local, you know, whatever it would be.
Understood.
But if you look at the big events, like the top 100 arenas in this country, Ticketmaster has exclusive contracts with 80 of them. And the fact, by the way, that Ticketmaster has this relationship with Live Nation means that it has deep pockets so that it can go out and secure new clients or maintain the clients that it has, because it can offer them large signing bonuses and it can offer them large advances against service fees. And by the way, go ahead.
Sorry, we just have a few seconds left, so I just want to ask really quickly, do you think that this will be the straw that breaks the proverbial camel's back with the Justice Department, and they may look into breaking up Live Nation and Ticketmaster?
It's tough to call. It's really tough to say, because, you know, this came up again. This has come up a couple times with Springsteen. This came up with Hannah Montana. An early iteration of this came up with Pearl Jam. People get worked up for a short period of time, and then they move on to other things. I mean, maybe post-COVID, public policy, you know, we'll decide as a country, or Congress will decide that music is so much enmeshed within necessary culture of the United States that we have to do something. But I think that remains to be seen. Every time in the past this has been raised, it's been business as usual.
All right. Dean Budnick, co-author of the book Ticketmasters, The Rise of the Concert Industry and How the Public Got Scalped. Dean, thank you.
Sure. Thank you.
Coming up, another Supreme Court decision involving reproductive rights was leaked 8 years ago. It was written by Justice Samuel Alito, who also wrote the leaked Dobbs decision overturning Roe v. Wade. We'll discuss with our legal, Jessica Levinson, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Turns out the leak of the Supreme Court's Dobbs decision overturning Roe v. Wade was not the first time that happened. Over the weekend, the New York Times reported that back in 2014, evangelical Christian activists learned of the Hobby Lobby decision before it came out. That case allowed the craft store giant to deny birth control coverage to its employees on the basis of its founders' religious beliefs. And it set a precedent for other privately held companies. Well, Justice Samuel Alito wrote that decision. He also wrote the Dobbs decision. And here with her analysis is our legal, Jessica Levinson, professor at Loyola Law School. Hello.
Hello. Just when we thought it was going to be a slow legal news week.
I know. Well, we still don't know who leaked the Dobbs decision for sure. But this is kind of tantalizing, right? Because it's the same justice. So what are the odds that he or someone close to him was the one who leaked the Dobbs decision?
It is absolutely tantalizing. And Madeline, you and I talked about this back when the Dobbs decision was leaked, which was obviously a legal and political earthquake. And I said, I think it's from a conservative justice or law clerk, because they actually have more to gain. And at the time, I thought they were trying to basically shame Justice Kavanaugh into not changing his mind and joining Chief Justice John Roberts for a kind of compromise that wouldn't have actually overturned Roe v. Wade. Now we have a little bit more evidence that there is another, in this case, alleged leak in another decision written by Justice Alito, also about abortion and religious rights. So obviously we don't have hard and fast answers here, but it is just fascinating to see how this is playing out. And for me, one of the really interesting parts of this other alleged leak is the amount of influence and lobbying that goes on behind the scenes to try and get Supreme Court justices to rule your way.
So interesting. Okay, so for people who didn't read the big New York Times story, give us just a thumbnail version of what is in that story and what they're saying happened with this decision and who the major players are.
So one of the major players here is somebody named Shank, and he used to lead an evangelical nonprofit in Washington, and he was very much involved in lobbying towards many of the cases that led up to the overturning of Roe v. Wade. And basically what he said is he got tipped off to what the decision in that case you were talking about before, Hobby Lobby, what it was going to be before the decision came out. Now, why does that matter? It allowed him to get prepared for it. It allowed him to try and already start the public relations machine going. And it allowed him to later actually tip Hobby Lobby off and say, you're going to win this case. Again, a case where the court said in a 5-4 decision, a really close decision, that we're going to allow for-profit corporations that say it violates my religious beliefs to have to provide my employees with contraception, we're going to allow them to opt out of that part of the Affordable Care Act. And there's a very long story here about how he knows somebody who had dinner with Justice Alito and his wife, and Justice Alito basically let it slip in that dinner what exactly the decision was going to be. But the idea is that the leak happens in that dinner behind the scenes. Mr. Shank is eventually tipped off, and that's basically the story here.
And so I imagine that Justice Alito and others around him strongly deny that he was the source of the leak.
Justice Alito has said under no uncertain terms that he absolutely was not the source of the leak. He has denied it outright. And of course, on the other side, we have reporting from the New York Times that say, yes, there are some gaps, but we've talked to people who learned at the same time that Mr. Shank was saying, yes, I was just tipped off. I know what the outcome of this case is going to be.
Well, meanwhile, Justice Roberts said that he was going to investigate this leak and try to find out how it happened. The Dobbs decision I'm talking about. So what is happening with that investigation? Is it actually happening?
So we don't know. This is not a public investigation. It's really being run in-house in the Supreme Court. And my sense is that we probably will never find out exactly what happened. Or there's some suspicion of what happened, and we're kind of slow walking that investigation until interest fizzles. So again, my sense is that probably when it comes to this particular alleged leak, even though there will be more questions, there may be no more answers. And in the Dobbs case, if people just will not talk, then the way the investigation is set up, I'm not sure they will ever be forced to do so.
But as you say, aside from that, you have a picture of a justice having dinner and socializing and being very close with these activists on the Christian right. And that calls into question the independence of this body. And once again, perhaps damages the reputation of the court.
For me, that was the really big takeaway here. Not that there was an alleged leak, but that there's this incredibly intricate web of different stakeholders, donors, activists who are really working in a concerted effort to try and lobby Supreme Court justices. Now, this might sound familiar because this is, of course, what we expect when it comes to politicians. But as you said, the judiciary is supposed to be independent. And the whole idea behind us respecting their decisions is that they're not just politicians in robes. We really, in some ways, view them as magicians. They come out behind a curtain, they hear oral arguments, they disappear again. And then months later, they say, okay, we found the law and here it is. And that whole experiment and our respect for them really evaporates if they just look like any other group that can be aggressively lobbied by different stakeholders. And that's part of the picture here. I think it does nothing but terrible things for the integrity of the court.
Jessica Levinson, she teaches at Loyola Law School, and she joins us most Mondays with her insight and analysis. Thank you.
Thank you.
Up, the collapse of the crypto exchange FTX has raised questions about a philosophy of giving its CEO practice known as effective altruism.
We should do much more for each other. We should give away a lot of our income or even nearly all of our income to help save lives.
How some high flyers in Silicon Valley compromise that idea next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. When the cryptocurrency exchange FTX collapsed into bankruptcy earlier this month, a lot of the attention turned to its now disgraced leader, Sam Bankman-Fried, and the billions of dollars he and his company lost. But it also turned to a philosophical ideology he regularly espoused and became the face of in Silicon Valley. It's called effective altruism. The concept, in theory, is to identify the world's big problems, especially ones that don't get a lot of attention, and then use logic and data to most effectively help those causes. For example, giving money to charities that provide medical supplies in poor countries instead of similar charities doing the work here in the U.S., because that money will go a lot further in poor countries. So that sounds pretty simple on the face of it. But in the wake of Bankman-Fried's downfall, what becomes of this movement, the effective altruism movement? And was it just bunk all along, like his promises? Joining us to talk about it is Annie Lowry, staff writer at The Atlantic, who covers economic policy. Hi, Annie.
Hi there.
Okay, so tell us a bit more about this idea, effective altruism. What is it and who came up with it?
This idea of effective altruism comes, the sort of intellectual headwater is on a very famous Australian utilitarian philosopher named Peter Singer. And so Peter Singer's philosophy holds that we can do much more for each other, that we should value all lives as equally as we value our own or those of our family members or the people living in our country, and that we should do much more for each other. We should give away a lot of our income or even nearly all of our income to help save lives. This idea strikes the fancy of some young philosophers. They were actually students at the time at the University of Oxford. One is a Scottish guy named Will McCaskill. Another is a philosopher named Toby Ord. And so they sort of take this and they make it really practical. And they say, you should give 10% of your income or all of your income above a certain fairly low level. And you should give it to the most effective charities out there that are changing the most lives. And these tend to be pretty unsexy causes. So things like giving anti-malarial bed nets in some countries that are prone to malaria, or stopping children from dying of diarrheal diseases. Almost all of this is giving to the poorest people in the poorest countries on earth. So that's the kind of core idea of effective altruism.
And it sounds great. So how is it now being tainted by this cryptocurrency collapse?
So I think that that core idea is not one that people push back on really hard. Although some folks will say something like, some things are easier to measure and some are harder to measure. So for instance, perhaps giving to a political cause that expands the rights of women in a certain place or a certain country, how should we value that against giving malarial bed nets away? Those are really hard questions to answer. And at some point they're political. There's a really wonderful philosopher named Abhya Srinivasan who has said that this movement sort of discounts the structure of economies and it discounts politics and political pressure in some way. And I think a lot of effective altruists take that to heart. But there's been sort of two more controversial things. So one is this idea of earning to give. So many effective altruists say you should make as much money as you can in a job that is maybe not the most ethical job, right? Being a corporate lawyer or something like that, in order to give the money away. So this is a very, very controversial idea. And then the second thing is a lot of effective altruists became enthralled with this idea called long-termism, which is that we should value lives in the distant future like we value our own. So if there is some chance of, for instance, AI becoming sentient and killing all humanity, even if that's a small chance because it would preclude trillions of lives from existing, we should take that threat seriously. And yeah, we should be giving away those anti-malarial bed nets, but let's also spend a lot of money on those trillions of future people. This is very controversial. Sam Bankman-Fried is very associated with this idea, as is Will McCaskill. And Sam Bankman-Fried is also one of these earn to give people who ended up, you know, perhaps seemingly running a Ponzi scheme in order to give the money away.
Right. And sort of whitewashing all that with his altruism or his pretense to altruism.
Yeah, the effective altruism, you know, because he's giving it away, he's willing to justify it seems like, we don't quite know exactly what happened, but perhaps stealing money in an effort to give it away. And also, you know, as you point out, reputationally laundering himself by being charitable, which is, I would call that pretty ethically questionable.
Well, he's certainly not the first mega rich person to try to do that.
Absolutely not.
I guess I wonder what the original guy, Peter Singer, would make of all this, because as I understand him and his philosophy, he was pretty much wildly against any form of corporate greed.
Yeah, I would say that a lot of effective altruists. So, you know, there's roughly, you know, several thousand people who kind of identify themselves as effective altruists, probably more than that. And it's become a really influential subculture online and in the Bay Area. People will sort of say, oh, I'm an EA or I'm an effective altruist in the same way that they might say, you know, I'm a vegan or I'm a leftist. And a lot of these folks are giving away 80% of their income. They're vegans. They think a lot about, again, children dying of malaria diseases. And a lot of them were really uncomfortable with a lot of this. There were a number of them who sort of said, yeah, I'm not really comfortable with earning to give. We want to have some humility and we can't predict the future in this way. And this is getting all very mathy and abstract when the really core idea is that there are problems in the world that are tractable and we can solve. And let's just give the money away. Let's not make this about our hubris. And so there's this real tension within the movement. And I think that the worst thing to come out of this would be the sort of disgracing of these charities that EAers have loved to promote, who are doing really, really great work in some of the poorest and most unstable places in the world, who are helping primarily children and women in a lot of cases in these places, and who desperately need more funding to help save lives in a very concrete, tractable sense. And it's a lot about giving them the money because they know what to do with it. And so I think that that's the idea that we want to salvage, because the Sam Bankman-Fried stuff, the crypto stuff, it had gotten very abstracted. And I think it would be a real shame if this made people think twice about, especially about some of those charities. Because, you know, the broader point of let's make altruism accountable and effective, I think is a really good one.
Yeah, absolutely. And then it also gets tied into this idea of a guaranteed basic income, right? This idea that you raised about how people who need the money, they know better than anyone else how they should be spending their money, and we should just give them the cash.
Absolutely. So importantly, effective altruists were not the first people to think about, like, how do you get the biggest bang for your buck if you're giving a dollar away? And effective altruism builds on a movement in development economics that's sometimes called the randomista movement, or, you know, the economists identified with it are known as the randomistas. And they basically ran these randomized control trials in very, very, very poor places and said, okay, if we're going to spend a dollar, should we spend it on this school, or should we spend it on this water pump, or should we give it away as cash? And very often cash would win. But, you know, there was a check, and the randomistas would be the first to sort of tell you that people have preferences that are not always captured by the way they want money spent. But this is why giving away cash is such a powerful tool, and one that EAers have been associated with, along with a lot of economists, along with policy experts in a lot of developing countries who started building really big cash programs. So the biggest ones some of the biggest and earliest ones are in Mexico and Brazil, where it's policymakers there that come up with this idea of, okay, like, let's just transfer the money away. And so there's lots of great ideas here. And in some ways, I think it's good to be skeptical of any one philosophy, any one approach, and of saying that, you know, we can determine these things with any degree of certainty, right? The world is really complicated. What people want matters. But when in doubt, defer to giving to the poorest people and defer to giving them simple things that they can use in the ways that are most powerful to them, which is often cash.
Annie Lowry is staff writer at The Atlantic, where you can read her article, Effective Altruism Committed the Sin It Was Supposed to Correct. Annie, thank you.
Thanks so much for having me.
Coming up, some ideas to spice up your Thanksgiving, a selection of ideas from cookbook authors and our own Evan Kleiman. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It's Thanksgiving week, and every year around this time, we like to revisit some of the interviews we did with chefs and cookbook authors over the past year. And we hope it might inspire you to create some new traditions with your family or help you finalize your holiday menu. This year, though, we're not going to start with a recipe. Instead, we've got a kitchen hack from the man who made his name with Kitchen Hacks, chef and cookbook author Kenji Lopez-Alt. Earlier this year, we had him on to talk about his new cookbook, The Wok. And he says The Wok is an underappreciated pan that can be used to make all kinds of dishes.
Well, first of all, it's extremely versatile. So, you know, you can do everything from making stock in it to obviously stir frying. It's the best tool for deep frying. It's the best tool for steaming. You can smoke in it. There's a whole slew of things you can do in a wok. You know, but moreover, it's also just an extremely practical tool for all kinds of cooking. So particularly for sort of weeknight cooking, you know, whether you're having friends over or you're cooking for your family and you only have like half an hour. And, you know, it's like I sound like an infomercial talking about this. It is really true. Yeah. And it's funny because the infomercial, there's an infomercial from the 80s that I grew up watching called The Great Wok of China, you know, selling woks. And it really is like the first time I really started paying attention to woks, and everything they said in it was true.
Right. So I always associated a wok with stir fry, and that's pretty much it. Like I didn't consider other kinds of cooking in it, like cooking an omelet or, I don't know, cooking pasta or whatever it is that is usually done in other pans. But you say you can cook all of these other non-Chinese dishes in the wok?
I mean, you know, most of the book focuses on East Asian techniques. So a lot of it is Chinese. A lot of it is sort of Chinese-American dishes that, you know, I was familiar with growing up. There's a bunch of sort of Japanese stuff in there, as well as other sort of Southeast Asian recipes. But yeah, certainly you're by no means, you know, relegated to doing that. You know, so one example that I frequently bring up when people ask, like, you know, what is something that I would do in a Western pan that is actually better in a wok is deep frying. So a lot of people are afraid of deep frying. And I think a lot of that comes down to the difficulties of using something like a Dutch oven or a stock pot and the mess that it can make when you add food to it. It can bubble over. People are afraid of setting fires. And a wok, you know, because of its flared shape, it has these wide sides that come out really wide. And so when you put food in it to deep fry, you know, first of all, any sort of oil that splatters, it gets caught on the sides of the wok instead of going over and onto your stovetop. So there's less cleanup. And then you can also sort of get a, you know, metal spider or a strainer and maneuver stuff in there more easily, which is also, I think, what makes it easier to do things like poaching or simmering. So even things like pasta, you know, like they work really well in a wok because it's very easy to get like a spider or a strainer under there to move things around. Poaching eggs is really easy in a wok.
Chef and cookbook author Kenji Lopez-Alt. His latest cookbook is called The Wok, Recipes and Techniques. Okay, now on to some recipes for your Thanksgiving feast. And let's be honest, when it comes to the average holiday meal, well, a lot of the main staples don't exactly pack the boldest of flavors. Turkey, mashed potatoes, gravy, stuffing, squash. It is a lot of beige. Well, here with a dash of color is Ukrainian cookbook author Anna Voloshina. She told us about her spicy and sour tomatoes when we had her on to talk about her new cookbook, Budmo, Recipes from a Ukrainian Kitchen. Be warned, though, if you want to make these, you have to start now because they need a few days to ferment.
Oh, my God. These tomatoes, like, first of all, the secret is in the marinade. It's not just like vinegar and oil or like brine. No, it's just like this thick, vibrant mixture of green bell pepper and hot jalapeno and vibrant herbs, and it all comes together with a little bit of oil, white vinegar, sugar and salt, and I just love how this complex marinade changes tomatoes over time. So you can eat those, like I usually use small tomatoes that are very good for pickling because they are small, they're soft, they're full of flavor, and they will absorb the flavor fast. But I like those tomatoes like 1 week after I made the marinade, and I just love the sourness and the texture of them. But some people like to eat them the same day. My mom says 3 days is like amazing. I say 1 week is my sweet spot, and they can keep in the fridge for like 2 or 3 months even. And those tomatoes taste as good as summer tomatoes.
So is this a good way to make meh kind of yucky tomatoes taste good? Or do you need to have really good tomatoes to start with?
I think you need to start with great produce to have a great dish. This is a must. I try to follow this rule. I try to get the best produce I can. And I'm very lucky to be in San Francisco where everything is available. But yes, this recipe can save meh tomatoes.
That's Anna Voloshina, author of the new cookbook, Budmo, Recipes from a Ukrainian Kitchen. Okay, that's one option for a zesty side dish. Another idea we have for you is from Navajo chef Freddy Bitsui. In his cookbook, New Native Kitchen, Bitsui has a recipe for Calabasas squash, tomatoes, and queso fresco. It's named for what is now Calabasas, California, which was home to the Chumash. Bitsui says this dish is really reflective of the kind of crops they grew and that we still grow here in Southern California.
It's squash, tomato, green chili, and cheese. And it's sauteed together to where, you know, everything's wilted. And it has this very great fall, winter kind of flavor. And since dairy product is not Native American, like Native American people did not preserve milk to any type of cheese or yogurt or anything in capacity. Cheese is such a European product. But however, queso fresco is kind of like was a new way of making cheese in the Western Hemisphere. So I call that Native American cheese. And it's crumbly. It doesn't, when I eat it, because I'm lactose intolerant, when I eat it, it doesn't upset my stomach. So anytime that I use cheese, it will be queso fresco.
And what do you spice it with?
Everything is just pretty much salt and pepper. Sometimes people put paprika or chili powder in there, but with Native American flavor, the chili itself, the actual pepper is the spice. So there's really not necessarily, you know, a spice rack full of different ingredients that you would put in most native foods.
That's Navajo chef Freddy Bitsui. His cookbook is called New Native Kitchen, Celebrating Modern Recipes of the American Indian. Okay, so that's your sides. Next up, something to sop up all that tasty Thanksgiving goodness. And usually that's what bread is for. But instead of bread, may we suggest handmade tortillas for the table? Maybe a Thanksgiving taco? Sacrilege? Maybe. But think about it for a second. Is there a more effective vessel to achieve the perfect Thanksgiving bite than a tortilla? I mean, it's really perfect. You put a little turkey, some stuffing, a dollop of cranberry sauce, a splash of gravy, fold it together in a soft, sturdy tortilla. Voila. It could work, yeah. Earlier this year, I spoke with Jorge Gaviria about his cookbook, Masa, Techniques, Recipes, and Reflections on a Timeless Staple. And while we didn't run the idea of a Thanksgiving taco by him, he did explain how easy it was to make tortillas by hand, especially if you have the special flour for it called masa harina.
Let's just make this easy. Let's start with masa harina. So okay. Very, very technically, pretty easy. You're just going to take like equal parts by volume water and masa. Masa harina, mix them together and get to a consistency that's wet, but like not super tacky or sticky in your fingers. And you're going to get a tortilla press. If you don't have a tortilla press, you can use, you know, anything that's flat. You could use books, basically a MacGyver press. Wield the shape of a tortilla. And if you don't have that, you can make tons of shapes without a tortilla press. You know, sopes, you can make, you know, arepas, mm-hmm. tamales. If you're using a tortilla press to make a tortilla, you know, get just press it. I mean, like, just roll a ball, put it on the surface of the tortilla press plate, close the lid, open it back up, and you've got a tortilla. Cook it for about 20 seconds per side till it's cooked through the center, and you got a tortilla. I mean, it's pretty astounding once you do it, especially using Masarina. You realize how easy it is to kind of just take that extra, I don't know, like 5 minutes, and you have kind of a transcendental experience, if I can say that.
Mm, you can.
Yeah.
And I'm convinced. I'm converted.
That was the goal. Thanks, Madeline.
That was Jorge Gaviria, author of the cookbook Masa: Techniques, Recipes, and Reflections on a Timeless Staple. Now, time for dessert. And for that, of course, we turn to the dessert queen, KCRW's own Evan Kleiman. Last year, we talked to her about one of her favorite holiday recipes. It's chocolate gingerbread, and it's from Nigella Lawson's cookbook, Feast. Evan says it hits all the right holiday notes with warming spices like ginger, cinnamon, and nutmeg, and a little chocolate to balance out the sweetness.
So the recipe, you know, it looks really long. It's all those spices and all those different sugars, but it's really easy. You do it all in one pan, and you mix it up with a spoon. So first you're melting the butter with all the different sugars and spices. Then you beat in the milk and eggs in the same pan. And then you just add the flour and cocoa powder and chocolate chips, although I use chopped chocolate. And then you bake it. It's just unbelievable. Plain. It's great with Nigella's icing, but icing is a bit too much for me. So I started serving it with lemon curd, which I just think offsets the richness of all those spices and the chocolate really well.
Yum. I think I would like whipped cream.
It is really great with whipped cream. And if you're going to eat just a square of it, that's really great. Of course, you know, you don't have to make your own lemon curd. You can always buy it. Mm. There's lots of great lemon curd out there in a jar.
Yeah. Why chocolate? What does that do to the traditional gingerbread recipe?
Well, strangely enough, well, maybe not so strangely, when you add cocoa powder in particular to a recipe, it acts sometimes as adding coffee does to a recipe, where it tamps down sweetness. So it adds this extra layer of richness because of the cocoa butter, but it also just has such a deep, complex flavor that it really rounds out all the sweetness. And one of the most interesting things about this cake is that it's such a great base for making a trifle. So if you're really entertaining, you're having a group of people over, you can make this cake that's so easy to make, and you just cut it up in pieces and layer it in a glass bowl with the lemon curd and whipped cream, and people go crazy for it.
Oh, what is a trifle, by the way?
A trifle is a layered dessert that consists of usually some kind of sponge cake, often a sugar syrup of some kind to moisten the cake, and then jam and whipped cream. I'm using this squidgy kind of damp chocolate gingerbread, so you don't really need to moisten it, although I have in the past used a lemon sugar syrup to do so. And then instead of the jam, I'm using the lemon curd, and then of course the whipped cream.
That's Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food, and you can find the recipes for chocolate gingerbread, Evan's lemon curd, and all the other recipes we just talked about online at, write this down now, KCRW.com/alternative-thanksgiving-recipes, all one word, KCRW.com/alternative-thanksgiving-recipes. Happy eating! that'll do it for us today on Press Play. You know, you can follow us online at Twitter on Twitter or on Instagram. We are at KCRW Press Play, and you can tell us what you like and what you don't like, what you want to hear more of or less of. Just be kind. It is Thanksgiving, after all. I'm Madeline Brand. Thanks for listening. I'll see you tomorrow.